last. We're here at the last of the great precepts, not to do anything to diminish the three treasures. There are many wordings of this precept, not to harm the three treasures or the three jewels. Norman's negative and positive interpretation, not to do anything to diminish the triple treasure, but to support and nurture it. Then there's a Soto Shu version. Self-nature is mysteriously profound. In the midst of one Dharma, in the midst of one great truth, not to give rise of mind of sentient being or Buddha being is called no abusing the three treasures. So let's look at this one as it appears a little enigmatic. First, what are the three treasures? They are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We'll look at each of these in a bit, but now I want to ask, what does it mean to not give rise of mind to sentient being or Buddha? This was brought home to me at the end of Sesshin recently, when at the closing Hōzen Shiki ceremony. Hōzen Shiki is where one by one we approach Dzogchen Norman in front of the whole assembly and ask him a question from the heart. He immediately responds. My question was, yes, beings are numberless, and I vow to save them, but I don't seem to be able to save a single one. And I was referring to my brother, as Norman knew, who was violently insane. His response to me was, there are no beings, which I believe is from the Lotus Sutra. As usual, I had to ponder this over a few days, but when I finally asked myself, why are there no beings? It just popped out to me that there are no beings that are separate from everything else. Usually, I just expect to absorb things. I step out my door and ponder the woods, or I mull over something I don't yet understand just by mulling it over. But now I realize that by asking myself a question, I change. If you re-examine the same thing in a different context, new things sometimes appear. So as a Dharma teacher, it is my job to encourage you to connect with your Buddha nature. Or as Jean recently encouraged us at the one-day sitting, to cross over that liminal bridge. One question I especially like regarding awakening is, if not now, when? What are we waiting for? So back to the Soto Shu version of the precept. We're being told not to abuse the three treasures by entering into a dualistic state of mind where we isolate the Buddha or any sentient being from their absolute interconnection with everything else. We'd be essentially abusing the Dharma, that is, the teachings of the Buddha. We are told in the Lotus Sutra that abusing or speaking ill of the three treasures condemns us to the Avicii hell, the lowest realms of hell, where we would suffer for 1,400 kalpas, and a kalpa being the time it takes for a feather to brush down Mount Sumeru. So we certainly don't want to do that. Although it should be noted that at the end of that time, a bodhisattva would come down to recite the Lotus Sutra to us, and we would be reborn awakened. So we recently concluded a hybrid ceremony by chanting the precepts and our bodhisattva vows. The last precept here was, I vow to cherish and polish the three treasures. I understand the gist of this wording, and yet I have a hard time visualizing myself polishing them as if they were objects or things. But nonetheless, I will challenge, I will cherish them. A little over 40 years ago, I entered Tassajara after a year and a half at Green Gulch Zen Temple. Roshi let me take my potter's wheel, kick wheel, down to make some pots on what little time off we had. Over the course of the 90-day practice period, I managed to throw 60 some odd teacups for Zendo use. I did an odd thing to them. Into each teacup, while it was still malleable, I put 3 indents halfway up the cup. Thus, when the cup was half full of tea, a shape like a 3-leaf clover was revealed as a triple treasure. I didn't tell anyone about this then, just privately wondering if anyone would get it. I wasn't being cute, but this is an expression of how much I relished the 3 treasures. I got a shock at our session in March when Dawu told me that the cups are still in use down there. How could that be? Didn't anyone know that broken pottery is what keeps potters in business? That triple treasure must be what preserves them. How can you express the triple treasure? How can we appreciate the triple treasure of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? When we take refuge in the 3 jewels, we also take refuge in our Buddha nature and our potential for liberation. When you take refuge in the 3 jewels, you aren't taking refuge in 3 external objects. You're taking refuge in the potential that lies within you. What we can do is to become more aware, deeply experiencing our relationship to the whole. As Norman recently lectured, and quoting Suzuki Roshi, Buddha nature is beyond good and evil. Acknowledge what Buddha nature is. Don't try to attach pure or get away from evil. It is big mind, not small mind. True nature is things the way they really are, beyond good and evil. So, examining the 3 jewels, let's start with the Buddha. We're all familiar with the story of Shakyamuni Buddha, and we just celebrated his birth. But the Buddha is more than just Shakyamuni. He is a part of all of us, no matter how hidden this seems. I see the Buddha everywhere I look. The redwoods, the sangha, the children, the explosion of wild irises on my hill, the strawberries, the stones that make up stairs to my meditation hut. All this I bow to and try to imagine reciprocity to, giving thanks for all I receive. I and we are interconnected to all of this. The Japanese have a practice of forest bathing, Shinrin Yoku, which involves fully taking in the forest through all of one's senses for an hour or two at a time. So, back to the Buddha. There's the Nirmanakaya Buddha, the Dharmakaya Buddha, and the Sambhogakaya Buddha. Dharmakaya Buddha, the body of ultimate reality. Sambhogakaya Buddha, the body of bliss and enjoyment. And Nirmanakaya, the body of transformation and manifestation, or the Buddha as we think of him, as our ultimate teacher. These are the manifestations of the enlightened Buddha. Next, we can look at Dharma, our second jewel. There are a couple of ways we refer to Dharma. The first is the teachings of the Buddha. That's a capital D Dharma, which is a very rich field of reading in the Pali Canon, which is a huge undertaking. It includes the Heart Sutra and the teachings of emptiness, with which Kathy Fisher is exploring in her lectures on Nagarjuna presently. I've said before that I always think of fullness when I hear the word emptiness, as nothing is reified, concretized, but rather always in a state of change and thus full of possibility. The other way we may use the word Dharma is to think of it as the ultimate reality, the reality of all birth and death and everything we encounter. Simply, the way things are. Finally, let us examine Sangha, the community of Buddhist practitioners. We, with our friends in our everyday Zen community, and yet we could look at its constituents. We have a Sangha that attends these precept classes. We have a Sangha that sits pretty much every morning on Zoom. We have a fresh Sangha at each one day sitting, as there are often a lot of newcomers that we welcome in. Then we have our special friends with whom we often interact with, as that is our close Sangha. We also have sister Sanghas on the North American continent. In the largest sense, there is a whole community of Buddhists worldwide upon which we may call out for special occasions like election retreats. Sangha is our support. We practice together and feel a warmth and comfort belonging to a Sangha. I feel especially blessed because I feel I'm a known part of many Sanghas. As I traveled with Norman for a few years, I was put up by families and Sangha members in Vancouver, Canada, Seattle, and Bellingham. Also by Galen Godwin and the Houston Sangha, to whom I'm very grateful. Sangha has been a very rich experience for me. Perhaps my reciprocity is in my sharing. The sharing of Dharma isn't a burden, but a humble joy for me. So here we are with the final precept, keeping the three treasures as the all-encompassing precept, which includes and caps all the previous precepts. This is the reason it is the last of the precepts, as what more could be said? If we vow to cherish the three treasures and do nothing to harm them, we have accepted a huge responsibility of compassion and kindness. Maybe responsibility is the wrong word, as it may seem as a duty, whereas there is so much joy in this precept that we are welcoming it into our lives with full appreciation. Thank you all. So we'll have a moment of silence. And now Steve will help us out.
I want to put this on gallery so I can pretend like we're in person. There we go. Jeff, I remember when you gave your way-seeking mind talk about 20 years ago, I think. And you said, "In it, if not now, when?" And it really had a big impact on me. There we go. So I want to start by reading something from Reb Anderson's book, Being Upright. And he describes how Suzuki Roshi sustains the triple treasure. Suzuki Roshi often said that his main job as a Zen priest was to encourage people to practice upright sitting. This was his primary way of protecting and sustaining the triple treasure. For him, the most pure and direct way of sustaining the Buddha treasure was just to be fully himself in each moment. His way of protecting the Dharma treasure was to practice wholeheartedly with no gaining idea. And his way of protecting and sustaining the Sangha treasure was what he called group practice, practicing together in harmony, which he upheld even to the detriment of his physical health. Early in my practice experience, I learned about the triple treasure and that as Buddhist practitioners, we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. This was not the case for me. I said it a lot, but I was not feeling it at the time. I started this practice by accident. I had learned to meditate from a doctor who was helping me with severe insomnia I was having at the time. So I started sitting for an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening, and before too long, I was cured. Soon after I started sleeping normally, I started to slack off on my meditation. I kept saying I wanted to get back to it, and a friend told me about a meditation group that met in the East Bay where I live. So I went to it. We sat for 45 minutes, then had a break to have tea and visit. As I was getting ready to leave, I noticed that everybody else went back to their seats. The guy at the front of the room, who seemed to be in charge, sat down facing everybody. So I sat down, not knowing what to expect. He proceeded to give a talk on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. I was completely blown away. I was unaware that this was a Buddhist thing, and it was love at first Dharma talk. It made so much sense, and it felt like what I'd been looking for, even though I didn't know I was looking for something. This was a Vipassana teacher who was affiliated with Spirit Rock. Soon after I started attending the teacher's Sunday night sittings, he advised me to go on a retreat. So I did. I went on lots of retreats. I was kind of a born again Buddhist, really gung ho, I think pretty obnoxious. I was in love with Buddhism, but I don't think I was sincerely taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I would say or chant it, but I'd be thinking about how I needed to do laundry or pick up milk at Safeway on my way home. This was my unconscious way of disparaging the triple treasure. I just really loved meditation and Dharma talks, but back then I was mostly a consumer of this practice. My transition to Zen. In the mid-90s, I went to a workshop called Company Time at Green Gulch Farm that was led by Norman, and like all of you, I was enamored with him. He was such a brilliant and selfless teacher, and I said to myself, I want to hang out with this guy. So I went to his Dharma talks as much as I could, and I continued to go to these company time retreats that we at the time had quarterly. For 30 years now, I've been a loyal and devoted student of Norman's. I've grown up a lot with the teaching, guidance, and mentoring he's generously afforded me. I was taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but I wasn't aware of it, as I still wasn't connecting with that when we chanted it. I was just going through the motions. I was chanting with the Sangha, but so often my mind was somewhere else. I was not making the effort to respect and connect with the triple treasure, but I continued to sit most days and feel fully engaged with Norman, our senior teachers, and of course, our community, all of you. In Norman's book, Taking Our Places, in his comment on the 10th grave precept, which is the 16th of the Bodhisattva precepts. Not to do anything to diminish the triple treasure, he says that this precept returns us to the beginning of these precepts. He emphasizes the importance of ethical conduct and how we can support and nurture the triple treasure by remembering and honoring these precepts we have vowed to uphold. If I'm telling a lie, I'm not honoring my vow to cherish and protect the triple treasure, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Norman goes on to say, the final precept affirms and reinforces all that has gone before. It is all 16 precepts rolled into one. It reconfirms us in our pledge to always make an effort to nurture and sustain our highest and deepest commitments, and never to knowingly choose to do anything that would diminish them in any way. I'd like to mention the things I think we can do that will help us sincerely and completely respect, protect, and share the triple treasure. First, nurture and strengthen your practice. Over the years, I have more and more been focused and diligent in my practice, but I also have gone through times when I'm distracted and not giving our practice the devotion and connection that I should. When I'm distracted or unhappy, I find myself practicing for the benefit of me, not for the benefit of others like we're taught. With the help of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, I always find my way back. On those occasions that we chant the three refuges, set an intention to focus and connect with every word you and the rest of us are saying. Study Dharma. Some of my favorite authors are Norman, Shohaku Okamura, and Thich Nhat Hanh. I'm in a small study group with a senior Dharma teacher and a few students like me. We meet weekly, and it is a real refuge for me. Find a group like that for yourself, or better yet, start one. I'm guessing that there are a lot of members of our Sangha that would be interested. Meet with your teachers often for Dokusan and practice discussions. Talk about questions you're having with your practice or problems, or just to check in. Take advantage of opportunities to attend Dharma events like our Wednesday night sitting, like our all-day sittings monthly, our 7:30 in the morning sittings. And then on the websites of Everyday Zen and San Francisco Zen Center and Berkeley Zen Center, there's all kinds of opportunities to engage with Dharma. And for those of you that don't live in the Bay Area, there's a lot of online offerings on these websites. So these are things that have helped me nourish my practice and my life. I've been making a sincere effort to pay close attention to my body and my mind and to give myself to our chants and rituals. When we say the Bodhisattva vows, I am focused and I try to mean it when I say, try to just mean every word. I'm going to say the four vows. You can say them too. And really focus on every word and really mean it. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them, all of them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them, even the difficult ones. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. I love to chant this every morning after we sit. Same thing when we chant sutras like the Heart Sutra or the Metta Sutta. I don't get lost in other thoughts much anymore when we chant. I feel happy when we chant, and I feel connected and focused. During practice period, our Shuso Laura offered a sutra writing class. What we did was start by very slowly writing the Heart Sutra. We did this in silence. It was just wonderful. It connected me with every word of the sutra. After writing, we would have discussion, including saying what stood out for us from the sutra we had been writing. There's a line in the Heart Sutra that stands out for me. Without hindrance, there is no fear. I also wrote the Metta Sutta, which has always been especially meaningful to me. You can do this. I recommend it. Bowing. Frequently, when I would bow, I would not experience any connection to it. I would be doing it because it was what we were doing at the time. At one of our Shosan ceremonies at the end of Sesshin several years ago, I asked Norman what he was expressing when he bowed. He said he was completely turning his life over to Buddha. This had a profound impact on me. Now that's often what I say to myself when we do prostration. I also feel affection when we bow to each other in greeting or welcoming. Dharma gates, seeing experience and interactions as Dharma gates. Sometimes when something difficult arises, I remember to see it as a Dharma gate. We enter Dharma gates often. I know for me, I don't always realize that's what I'm doing. I've entered Dharma gates from car crashes a couple of times. A couple of years ago, I was in Berkeley on my way to see one of Naomi's plays. A woman came out of a side street and smashed into the back of my car. She was very upset, but I felt pretty calm, which surprised and delighted me. I noticed that as we were exchanging information about insurance and phone numbers and so on, that her hands were shaking. I looked at her and said, "This is why God created insurance companies." And that made her laugh and made her know I wasn't angry with her. A couple of years ago during practice period, I was having coffee at a Pete's in Berkeley with my practice partner. When I came out to my car, the driver's side of my car was completely smashed in. I was in shock, but not real upset. Nobody left a note, they just left the scene. Then someone came up to me with pictures of a big Safeway truck that had hit my car. She had gotten the license plate number and waited for me to come to my car. I was pretty calm, but I was angry that the driver of the truck left, didn't leave me a note, didn't take any responsibility for the damage. When the police came, they asked if I wanted to press charges. I thought that probably this truck driver had a family and didn't make a lot of money. He didn't damage my car on purpose, and he probably panicked, and that's why he left the scene. He'd have to hire a lawyer and probably lose his job. And I said, "No, I don't want to press charges." This kind of calm and thoughtful response to this incident was just a natural byproduct of my practice. Dealing with a difficult situation can be a Dharma gate, an opportunity to deal with it with calm and compassion for yourself and anyone else involved. practice gratitude. I'm deeply grateful for the very unique benefit of having knowledgeable, devoted, compassionate teachers who have been practicing Zen for decades, like Jeff. Most people don't have that. Where would our practice be without our teachers? I'm grateful for Lord Buddha for relinquishing his privileged life after witnessing the suffering outside of his protected environment, for becoming enlightened for the benefit of all beings, and for teaching the path to liberation for 40 years. And now, 2,500 years later, here we are benefiting from Buddha's practice. I feel gratitude for our ancestors who documented and taught Dharma and formalized Buddhist religion and were careful to ensure that it was passed down to the next generation. And because of this, we have the opportunity to share this brilliant practice, and not just for ourselves, but for the benefit of others as well. It is the responsibility of the elders in our Sangha to ensure that our practice and our community continue to thrive long after we're gone. So you younger ones will someday find yourself in leadership roles in the not too so distant future. You will cherish your younger members as we do you. I'm grateful for our Sangha. We have a generous practice community that cares for and supports each other and shows up for our Dharma brothers and sisters when they're not well. From Shohaku Okumura's Living by Vow, the Buddha is the doctor, the Sangha is the medicine. No, I said that wrong. The Buddha is the doctor, the Dharma is the medicine. The Sangha are the nurses. Maybe we're all Buddhas as well as nurses. Where would we be in our practice and our life without Sangha? So I'm going to end here and thank you for listening. So let's just take a minute and breathe. So, we're going to break out into groups in just a minute. And the format will be 4 minutes each to speak and then take another 4 minutes to wrap up. And Jeff, we didn't talk about a question. I wrote down one.
One.
And it's just pretty simple. How do you protect and connect with the triple treasure?
That's pretty much what I was going to say. How
Okay.
can we go beyond just paying lip service to this last precept and make it a very real part of our daily life?
Very good. So Jeff is going to break us into